glad you're here. Fellowship's sweeter, knowing you're near. It's so good to see you. I hope that it's fair. Everyone loves you.
Hello, it's Wednesday. We're jumping right into part two of His Final Hours. Both yesterday and today's program are archived at greatnewsradio.org and wluj.org under the Mark and Friends tab. In case you missed a portion or want to listen to it again or pass it on in an email to a friend, we'll pick right up where we left off yesterday on part two of His Final Hours.
And now the conclusion of His Final Hours, Jesus of Nazareth. Convinced of Christ's innocence, but perhaps hoping to satisfy the bloodlust of the crowd, Pilate had Jesus flogged.
Chain him to that post.
Say, is that a crown you're wearing? What's this one's name?
They call him Jesus.
Not in the mood to talk, Jesus. I think I can change that.
Ask him how he got such a royal crown.
Yes, yes, tell us, King. Still not talking? Well, maybe this might help. We've whipped many a criminal, but this must be our very first king, and a king deserves a royal treatment.
Let him have it.
Have what, kind sir? Ah! A royal treatment!
The Roman centurions used what was called a cat of nine tails.
Once again, Dr. Walt Larimore.
It was a whip with literally nine strips of leather, roughly 3 feet long, a meter long, and embedded in those strips of leather were pieces of bone or metal or stone that were very, very sharp. And the historical record tells us that a centurion would tie a victim to a rock or to a post with their back exposed, and then that cat of nine tails would be swung in an arc so that it would land on the flesh of the back, and those bony fragments or those metal fragments would pierce the skin. And then once it had pierced the skin, then the centurion with all of his strength would rip the cat of nine tails off of the prisoner, stripping off initially skin and subcutaneous tissues. The pain is indescribable. The flesh would literally be torn off piece by piece to the point that if they continued this punishment, it would rip into the lungs, collapsing the lungs and killing the prisoner. Remember, this was torture, slow, horrible, painful, excruciating torture.
Luke 23:20-23 and John 19:16. Pilate, wanting to release Jesus, addressed them again, but they kept on calling out, saying, "Crucify, crucify him." And he said to them the third time, "Why? What evil has this man done? I have found in him no guilt demanding death. Therefore I will punish him and release him." But they were insistent, with loud voices asking that he be crucified. And their voices began to prevail. So Pilate then handed him over to them to be crucified.
Bearing the weight of a crossbeam in excess of 100 pounds, Jesus staggered through the heart of a noisy business district that was focused more on cash than a cross. The traditional route taken by Jesus, called the Via Dolorosa, is still there. And so is the noise, which all but drowns out the voice of Charlie Dye.
Yeah, we're walking up the Via Dolorosa right now. You hear the traditional sounds, the people buying and selling on both sides of the street. Actually, very much like what would have been the day that Jesus was carrying his cross from having been condemned from Pilate to Calvary. The people would have been buying and selling that day in preparation for the Passover as well. So in these crowded streets, people jostling into one another, the merchants and the shoppers, and these Romans pushing a man with his cross up the same street. It gives you the same kind of feel of what would have been like in that day.
Three criminals, and one of them a rabbi. Who'd have thought?
You talked high and mighty on the temple steps, but you look a little weak carrying that cross.
Oh, right this way, Your Majesty. Right this way. Nice crown.
So, you thought you were above all the rest. And now you will be up on the cross.
Well, well, isn't this the miracle, man? Hope you've got one left tucked away in that blood-soaked robe of yours.
Nizar Tuma suggests that in addition to the jeering mobs, the Via Dolorosa offered plenty of heavy hearts as well.
When he was walking the Via Dolorosa, I can feel his heart aching more. The woman who was walking around him, and I'm sure he went through many faces of people who were with him and close to him, and he would just see their faces when he was walking around. And the people who were shouting Hosanna, and you can imagine everybody of these people, every one of them, have some kind of touch through his eyes, like just him looking at them, not saying a word, can speak to their hearts. I'm sure it was not only Peter who went back and cried bitterly.
Friday, 9 a.m.
John 19, 17 and 18. They took Jesus, therefore, and he went out, bearing his own cross to the place called the Place of a Skull, which is called in Hebrew Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with him two other men, one on either side and Jesus in between.
Archaeological records as well as historical records tell us that the nails did not go through the hand. Remember that the Greek word that's translated hand actually includes the wrist also. And so the nail was placed in the wrist, just above the hand, and between the two arm bones, right in the wrist. A critical anatomical position because there was enough strength there to hang the entire body, number one. Number two, there are not large blood vessels there, so it wouldn't stimulate massive bleeding. But number three, there is a nerve plexus there. And so when a spike would penetrate that nerve plexus, it would send horrific electrical pain up into the arm, bursting through the chest, bursting into the brain. And then began the very, very slow process of death.
Ironically, that process of death was accelerated not so much by a loss of blood as a loss of oxygen. Again, Dr. Larimore.
When Jesus was hanging on the cross with his entire body suspended from his wrist, he's unable to breathe. And so he has to flex the muscles of his arms and his shoulders. And as Jesus would lift himself up to gasp a breath and then collapse back down with that pain, shrieking through his arms and legs. And then he'd have to repeat that again and again and again. And yet in that pain, who did Jesus think of? He thought of us. He thought of his mom. He thought of his friends gathered there. He thought of his captors and his torturers and asked his Father to forgive them. He thought of those hung on either side of him and their eternal future. If ever love in action was demonstrated, it was by this man who loved us enough to obediently go through this horrible torture for each of us.
Matthew 27, 55 to 56. And many women were there, watching from afar off, those who followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, among whom was Mary Magdalene, and Mary, the mother of James and Joses, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee.
All four Gospels mention the women who followed Jesus to his cross. Just how significant is such a detail? Dr. Lois Evans is Senior Vice President of the Urban Alternative.
I think it is significant. It shows how much value God placed in the ministry of women, how much he valued the gifts and skills that they had to offer his ministry, and how much they loved him as well, how much he loved them. You know, a mother never leaves a son's side, no matter what's going on. I don't care how old they are. Jesus was 33 years old, but it's still his mama. I can understand a mother's emotion of staying close to her son's side to the end because of commitment and dedication and the value they placed on the life he lived.
Who were these brave women who loved him so much? David Katz is assistant manager of Sarel Tours, Jerusalem.
Of course, the women, Mary Magdalene, who we in Hebrew know as Miriam of Migdal, and Miriam, his mother, and the others who, out of a great love for him, stayed with him throughout his death. And then, of course, Miriam of Migdal, Mary Magdalene, was the first to see him rise. And I think that's very, very important for all of us to understand.
And what can we learn from the courage of these women? Lois Evans.
And I think we can learn and gain strength from just watching them. And in even a desperate situation like that was, difficult situation as it was, risking their lives probably after walking with him that close, or risking rejection, they were still there, they were still committed and still dedicated to him. And I think that's what we can learn from them.
Nearly 6 agonizing hours had passed, and the end was near. But the suffering lasted till the very last second. Once again, Dr. Walt Larimore.
The dehydration, the hunger, the pain, the stress. It was the worst of the worst type of tortures that could be administered. And it was only administered to the worst of the worst prisoners. The suffering was so bad, it was so horrible, that a new word was invented called excruciating pain, the pain that comes out of crucifixion. And that's what Jesus went through for us.
Friday, noon.
My God, why have you forsaken me?
Do you hear that?
Even above the wind. Going crazy from the pain?
Not likely. Listen, I think he's calling Elijah.
It is finished.
What's he saying?
Into your hands I commit my spirit.
And behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook, and the rocks were split. Matthew 27, 51.
Friday, sunset.
When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered it to be given to him. And Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out in the rock. And he rolled a large stone against the entrance of the tomb and went away. Matthew 27, 57 through 60.
The tomb of Jesus. Like many sites in the Holy Land, scholars debate its exact placement. But two locations each seem to fit the biblical account. The first is a site known to tourists as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, a darksome structure originally built in 330 AD. David Katz.
We're in the middle of the Basilica of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I'm looking up right now at the dome, which was restored several years back. It's certainly a spectacular dome with the natural light coming through on the top, but then it's contrasted so much with the older traditional church's claim is the tomb of Jesus, where we're standing on history, and who can be anything but touched and inspired and encouraged?
How do we know this spot is actually where Christ's body lay? Dr. Charlie Dyer.
We have early Christian tradition. We have the geographical details of the Bible, and they all seem to come together, converge at this site. It's not what we would want it to look like. And there's another spot we go that's so much nicer. But my head says it's here. My heart goes to the other.
That other location is known today as the Garden Tomb, where John Salter serves as a chaplain.
Just outside the old city, to the north of the city, where there is a cliff face which looks exactly like a skull. Two sunken eye sockets and a rather bent nose and lower down a mouth. And you will remember that it says in the New Testament that Jesus was crucified in the place of the skull, Golgotha. Even more important than that, just beneath the site of the skull is an area which is now a bus station. Up until the time, just before the time of Jesus, it had been used as the Jerusalem execution site. So you've got a place outside the city wall that looks like a skull, that has association of skulls and bones, and could well be the place where Jesus was crucified. Hear me carefully, we're not saying it definitely is, because nobody can be that sure about any place actually in Jerusalem. But many people believe it is, and there is a very strong possibility.
John Salter is quick to point out that even if the exact burial location could be proven, it would merely be a symbol for a much more essential truth.
Whether this was the place or not doesn't really count. It was either here or within a few hundred yards of here. What really matters is the event itself and what it means. And the fact of the matter is that in the middle of the day, under the Middle Eastern sun, the sky went totally black. Jesus cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? People beat their breasts thinking that the end of the world had come. And the fact is that at that point, Jesus absorbed into himself the pain, the evil, the sinfulness of the world, because he took it all and he paid the price for it. And what matters is not whether this is the place. It's the fact that Jesus did that for us, and we need to respond, to believe, just to give our lives to him, to accept his forgiveness, and live our lives in total gratitude for what he's done for us. That's what really matters, more than any place.
Sunday morning, before dawn.
Matthew 28:2-4. And behold, a severe earthquake had occurred, for an angel of the Lord had descended from heaven and came and rolled away the stone and sat upon it. And his appearance was like lightning and his clothing as white as snow. The guards shook for fear of him and became like dead men.
Let's see. I think the tomb should be right over here. But what about the stone at the tomb's entrance? Who rolled away? I'm sure it'll be too big for us. It's been rolled away. The stone is rolled away. Oh, and look.
Don't be afraid. I know that you're looking for Jesus, who was crucified. He's not here. He has risen, just as he said. See the place where he was lying.
His burial clothes?
Now, go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead. He's going to Galilee. You'll see him there.
He's alive. He has risen.
The resurrection. Never before, never since. Never had anyone predicted their own death and resurrection and made it come to pass until Jesus. Overlooking the streets of Jerusalem, Charles Swindoll ponders what that moment might have been like.
I think, of course, the greatest triumph in all of the story of Jesus is his return from the grave. And, you know, we can all just imagine the magnificence of that moment, the fact that he has come back, that the promise has been fulfilled, that triumph has happened. He has been miraculously and bodily raised from the dead, and here he stands.
But in a day of cloning and DNA codes, just how plausible is the resurrection? Lee Strobel is a former legal editor of the Chicago Tribune. As an atheist, he looked at the facts of Christianity and ultimately reached a conclusion that surprised even him.
I think the resurrection of Jesus is entirely plausible. Let me give you a couple of reasons why. First, we have the empty tomb. Everybody in the ancient world agreed and admitted the tomb was empty. The question is, how did it get empty? Of course, the religious leaders made up the ridiculous story that the disciples stole the body. They didn't have the motive or the opportunity. Second, we have eyewitness appearances. Not just one or two, but over 500 people encountered the resurrected Christ over a period of days. People who were different. Some were tender-hearted. Some were very stone-hearted. Some were, happened indoors and outdoors to groups, to individuals. So we have eyewitness accounts. Third, we have early accounts of the resurrection. In other words, this wasn't legend that grew up over a long period of time. We have preserved for us a creed of the early church in 1 Corinthians 15 that summarizes the resurrection. It says Jesus died, why? For our sins. He was buried. He was resurrected on the third day, and then mentions the names of specific eyewitnesses, including skeptics who encountered him and whose lives were transformed. And the beliefs that make up that creed go right back to the cross itself. So we can have confidence. The empty tomb, the eyewitness appearances, the early accounts, the resurrection of Jesus Christ is an actual historical event.
A dead man walking. Perhaps a great movie title, but is something this unusual sturdy enough to build a life on? Again, Lee Strobel.
Well, this is really an historical issue. I would concede that this is not the norm, but could it have happened at one point in history? Well, that's an historical question. And when you take the tests of history and you apply them fairly to the historical record for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, you know, I come to the same conclusion that Sir Lionel Luckhoo came to. Sir Lionel Luckhoo, the greatest lawyer who ever lived, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, and he was a skeptic who spent years investigating the resurrection, and I will recite to you one sentence that summarizes his conclusion. He said, quote, "I say unequivocally that the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ is so overwhelming that it compels acceptance by proof, which leaves absolutely no room for doubt." And based on the evidence, Sir Lionel Luckhoo became a follower of Jesus.
Which is what Jesus would have you become, a follower. That's why he was born in the stable at Christmas. That's why he himself became the sacrificial lamb of Passover. Why he agonized in prayer at the garden. And that is why he lives today, that you might become a follower. This is the meaning and the message of his final hours. His Final Hours is a presentation of the Moody Broadcasting Network. I'm Leslie Staples.
This completes our 2 days of broadcast of His Final Hours, both archived at greatnewsradio.org
and WLUJ.org under the Mark and Friends tab.
May God bless you during this Holy Week, as tomorrow we contemplate Maundy Thursday, then Good Friday, anticipating Resurrection Sunday.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for being a part of our radio listening family. This is Mark Burns with the Ministry of Great News Media. God bless you and have a great day and night.